word. 880 WRFD.
We're back. This is Chris Long. I'm the president of the Ohio Christian Alliance, filling in for Bob this afternoon. In this hour, we're going to be talking to our good friend Bill Federer, and we're going to be talking about the year in review and what we can look forward to in 2009 and some of the work that he's being involved in currently. Also, you can listen at WRFD.com if you haven't, if you missed the interviews with Ken Blackwell and Dr. David Prentice. Also, at our website at OhioCA.org. That's the Ohio Christian Alliance website at OhioCA.org. Bill Federer is on the phone with us. Bill, welcome to Bob Burney Live.
Chris, great to be with you.
Well, thanks so much for taking time out on this holiday week to join us here at the program. And I just wanted to chat with you a little bit about 2008 in review and 2009 and maybe even from a historical perspective of where we're at, because I think there's a lot of questions that people have right now, what time comparison this is in American history where you have, in some instances, there's no comparative to it, meaning the financial crisis, the mortgage crisis, where we are in our republic, where we have runaway spending on the federal level. It doesn't matter if the Republicans or Democrats are in power in recent years. It's just runaway spending, and they're printing meaningless money, and there's fear of deflation, inflation, the mortgage crisis, and people are wondering which way to turn. So we called our good friend Bill Federer for the answers.
Well, first of all, it's great to be with you, Chris, and what we're seeing is a gradual transition away from the form of government that our founders gave us and moving toward more a socialist and collectivist and centralized form of government, which obviously will mean less freedoms. So I love what Ronald Reagan once said, the government that's big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take away everything you have. And so when we look to the government to be the health care, the welfare, all the retirement, then we have to give up rights and freedoms to see that take place. One of the things I've done in my study of history, there's been 6,000 years of recorded human history. That's really not that all, not that many. From the Egyptian and Babylonian empires to Alexander the Great to the Roman Empire, the Greek, the Ottoman Empire, Byzantine Empire, the Napoleon's Empire, you can trace it all the way up. But during that time, these empires have risen and empires have fallen. Empires have risen and empires have fallen. And they sort of go the route of an athlete. You know, when an athlete is young, he's fit, disciplined, focused, does his push-ups, wants to win that prize and will do anything to get it. And then after he becomes the champion, what happens? Well, you know, he rules for a while, and then he becomes a little bit lazy and doesn't exercise as much and ends up becoming a couch potato. Yet in his mind, he still thinks he's that young, fit guy, and then he gets challenged into the ring by the next up-and-coming athlete or culture, and he goes in there and gets the tar knocked out of him. And so that's what happens when, you know, the Mongolian Empire, when they were under Genghis Khan, they were conquering everywhere. And then after they conquered everything, under Kublai Khan, they became sort of indulgent, and Kublai Khan wanted to learn all the different cultures and the pleasures and so forth, and they lost their edge, and that's when all the different peoples that they had conquered broke away and got their freedom, and now Mongolia is what? You can't even find it on a map, you know. But at one point in time, the Mongolian Empire was the largest contiguous land empire in world history. But what do we get from learning about this? Well, look at America.
By the way, is that when China built the wall? Is that right, to keep out the Mongols? Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, that the Mongols had been invading into China for centuries, and finally, when they completed the Great Wall of China, it's when the Mongols began to charge in the other direction, and that was one of the things that, over time, led to those sort of dominoes falling of the different tribes overrunning the Roman Empire and later the Muslim invasions. Under the Turkish Mongols began to invade into what is today Turkey, but back then it was the Byzantine Empire. It was all Christian. So, but the point I guess I'm making is that America, if we were to pick a time when we were focused and self-disciplined and had a common Judeo-Christian ethic and we really felt like we were the best country in the world and we wanted to spread and share that with other countries, well, this would probably be during the time of Teddy Roosevelt to Franklin Roosevelt. But after that is when we began to, you know, have the hippies and the drug culture and the free sex and sort of lost our way in the 60s and early 70s. And now we're teaching in school that America is the problem with the world. And we're, instead of embracing our American culture, we're teaching multiculturalism and saying, well, ours isn't all that special. All the rest of them are just as good. And so we've basically passed that peak. Now, can we turn it around? Yeah, it's going to take quite an effort, but it's possible. But it would be going, it's this trend, again, toward concentration of power. I talk about this in my books. AmericanMinute.com is my website. But there's one concept that I call, it's called the patterns of power. And years ago I spoke at Phyllis Schlafly's Eagle Forum conference and I shared it. And that we basically went from the concentrated powers of the monarch to the separated powers of our Constitution, but we gradually are seeing a reconcentration of power. And it goes back into the hands of fewer and fewer people. When I teach in schools, I'll have the kids hold up a fist in one hand and say concentrated power. Then I'll have them hold up the other hand with their palm and their fingers separated, and I said separate powers. And then I say, now go back to that concentrated power. So we went from the concentrated powers of the monarch to the separated powers of our Constitution, separated from the federal to the state level, separated into three different branches, tied up with these handcuffs, these first 10 amendments. But after every crisis, we see a gradual reconcentration of power. And, you know, if you want, I can step us through it, because it is sort of enlightening to what we're going through today.
Well, we're going to take a break here. With us on the phone is Bill Fetter from the American Minute. You're listening to Bob Burney Live. I'm your guest host this afternoon, Chris Long, president of the Ohio Christian Alliance. And, Bill, when we come back after the break, I do want to get into that and talk about where we're at currently and, you know, obviously with the financial crises that are facing our nation and globally, what that might mean, as there are a number of nations that hold leverage against the United States now, holding bonds and notes against the United States. And so we want to talk about that. With us on the phone is Bill Fetter from the American Minute. We'll be right back after these messages. Don't go away.
When you think John MacArthur, think WRFD. Grace to you, weekday afternoons at 12:30 on The Word, 880 WRFD.
We're back, and with us on the phone is Bill Fetter from the American Minute. We're talking about the financial crisis in America, and of course, the crisis that we see even in our government in the central control of the agencies and the administrative branch. Bill, we have seen over the last number of years, and it has been a complaint from the left that the Bush administration has seized power. But in reality, obviously, the Patriot Act, there's debate about the Patriot Act. But President Bush, I'm not sure, was totally at fault here when he moved to do the kinds of things he needed to do to keep America safe from the war on terror. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's always a triangle going on, and it's back to that Hegelian idea. You know, our founders were really focused on separating power, and they were quoting from philosophers like Montesquieu and Locke and so forth. Well, there were other political philosophers that wanted to concentrate power. One famous one was Machiavelli. In the 500 years ago, in the 1400s in Italy, Italy wasn't Italy. Italy was a bunch of little kingdoms and dukedoms and princedoms and papal states and Siena, Genoa, Venice, and they were always fighting each other. And this guy, Niccolo Machiavelli, had an idea. He wrote a book called The Prince, primarily for Lorenzo de' Medici, one of the leaders of the Renaissance. But in his book, he says that it's good to concentrate power because then it'll stop all these little kingdoms from their little bitty wars fighting each other, and we'll have peace. And so he came up with this idea, the ends justifies the means. So in other words, if the prince marched into the village with an army and took over, the people would hate him. But if the prince paid insurgents to kill cows and burn barns and create terror, the people will cry out for help. The prince will go in there and stomp out and kill the guy that he bribed and take over, and the people will praise him as a hero. And that's called Machiavellianism. And so you multiply that by, you know, 500 years, and here we are today. We see that after every crisis, we see a gradual reconcentration of power. Now, not all of it, you know, people say, well, is it all conspired or whatever? It's just sort of human nature that we want everything to be done more efficiently. We want to get on the internet now. We want our coffee now, and we want the world problem solved now. Unfortunately, in order to do that, you've got to relinquish power to somebody else to do it. And over time, the power gets concentrated, and it never goes back. So FDR concentrated a whole lot of power. Lincoln, after the Civil War, I mean, it was great that Lincoln ended slavery, but in the process, he took a lot of rights away from the states that the states have never gotten back since. And so we see this gradual trend toward concentrating power. And another philosopher worth noting is one German named Hegel, George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. He started Hegelianism, and it's sort of like a triangle. On one corner is a thesis, on the other corner is the antithesis or antithesis, and then the top corner is the synthesis. And so the idea is that the thesis is where the people are at, the synthesis is where you want to take them, so you have to create the antithesis. In other words, you create the problem so people will want your answer. And it's really just marketing. No, you create the need and fill it. But when you apply that to politics, it takes a little different perspective. But, I mean, it's sort of like going around the back of the house, setting it on fire, then going around the front of the house and selling them a fire extinguisher, and they're happy that you're there, and they'll pay anything for it. And so what's the situation today is we do have a genuine crisis. Since 1938, the Muslim world is when oil was discovered in Saudi Arabia. And the West has been pumping billions of dollars into the most violent of Muslim countries. Saudi Arabia is where they have the Wahhabi version of Islam. So we've been pumping this over there, creating this crisis, so to speak. Whether it was intentional or not, I doubt, but nevertheless it happened. And so here we have this crisis, and so the answer to the crisis is what? Well, we have to give up more of our freedoms. We have to allow ourselves to be strip searched at the airport. We have to allow all the financial transactions to be tracked. We have to, you know, all these different things to stop the crisis, but in the process, we relinquish rights and freedoms. You know, withholding from your paycheck was an emergency effort to get money to fight Hitler during World War II. After the war stopped, it didn't, and they're still withholding money from our paychecks. And it was called the pay-as-you-go tax, and it was invented by Beardsley Rummel, who was the chairman of Macy's department stores, and then he began to work for the Treasury, and he came up with this idea of taking a little bit out of the employer so that it doesn't waste time going through the employee's bank account, and that way you can get the money to the war effort faster. And again, it was an emergency effort, and once the emergency was over, it stuck. And so that's where we're at today. There's genuine emergencies, and we have a genuine enemy, like Hitler was a genuine enemy, but in the process, we're seeing this gradual concentration of power, and only this time it's not just happening from state to federal level, it's happening from the federal governments around the world towards, you know, regional, you know, GATT, NAFTA, the European Union, but then, of course, the next step is a global type of union. And yes, things will be more efficient. You'll be able to, you know, grow the stuff in the cheapest country so that you can get it the cheapest way at the market, but the problem is you will lose freedom. And you'll lose sovereignty, and those are a lot of precious things that our founders fought and died for.
Well, here's one of the things that are going around. The various states is ratifying a motion to call for a constitutional convention. Have you heard about this with the with the intent of bringing a balanced budget to the Constitution.
Sounds good, and I'm in favor of a balanced budget, but we can do a balanced budget right now if we had the political will to. The problem is once you open a constitutional convention, it is open for everything in the Constitution. And just like the $700 billion bailout, as soon as it was passed, they began to spend money on stuff other than what they said they were going to spend the money on. Once you open a constitutional convention, they'll be fiddling with all kinds of different articles in there that was never thought of before the convention opened. And by the time it's done, it will be unrecognizable. And
Well, there are those who argue that the way that this, and I'm not sure how it works with the states ratifying it, it just came to Ohio. I'm not sure of its status, but a bill number came up, and obviously if it how does it work with the states ratifying this that that opens up a constitutional Congress?
I'm pretty sure it's three-quarters of the states, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, and so the argument is that it will only address a balanced budget amendment, no other items.
That's a nice thing, but again, once you open a constitutional convention, all you need is some kind of emergency to happen, and then they'll say, okay, well, we got this emergency. We know we promised everybody that, but now this emergency is here. We're going to take care of it. And they will this Constitution, for those that are not aware, it's the longest lasting free Constitution in the history of the world. That every other country was formed through war, conquest, greed, armies, fighting. America was a voluntary submitting of people to each other under God. Matter of fact, the word federal is Latin for covenant, because the church leaders had a covenant form of government. And so what happens is our Constitution was designed for one thing only, to limit the power of government. And after reading through Federalist Papers and writings and the founders and so forth, they understood human nature. Human nature is greedy. It's greedy on one side, where you have people going down the street robbing, and so you need to have the government have enough power to stop these bad guys. But on the other side, you could have these people going down the street robbing be elected to office, and they could be the government, and they could be wanting to rob you with the government's power, so that you need to limit the government's power. So I love what James Madison said, and I'm paraphrasing. He said, the first thing in creating a free government is to have the people relinquish enough power so the government can rule. But the second problem is you have to have the people retain enough power so that they can keep the government under control. It's sort of like you let the dog out of the cage, but you want to keep it on a leash. And that's the thing. It's like a nuclear reactor on a submarine, where you got these, you know, rods with uranium on them. And if you pull them out just right, you get that thing going, and it creates heat and makes that boiler work, and you got power. But if you pull it out too much, the whole thing melts down. And so it's this balance where you have to give the government enough power so that it can do its job, very limited job, of keeping the peace and protecting our borders, but you have to make sure you don't give it too much power. And now the trend is that people want to give the government too much power. I mean, look at Katrina. The reason that Katrina was so bad is because the governor of Louisiana waited 3 days to ask the federal government to come in. But people don't care that there's a state government and a federal government. They just said, federal government, you should have come in quicker. So what do we have? We have the people wanting the federal government to take more power. Well, yeah, they'll be able to step in quicker next time, but you're losing that sovereignty, and as power gets concentrated, I love what Woodrow Wilson said. He said, the history of liberty is the history of limitations of government power. He said, the concentration of power is the beginning of the destruction of human liberties.
Well, Bill, when we come back after this break, I want to ask you about our current situation, the financial crisis. It looks as if with the bailouts and taking over of private industry, that socialism is on the rise here in America, and what we can do to combat it. With us on the phone is Bill Fetter from the American Minute. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
Get today's news from a biblical worldview. Bob Burney Live, weekday afternoons at 3:30 on The Word, 880 WRFD. Talk radio that makes a difference. Bob Burney Live, weekday afternoons at 3:30 on The Word, 880 WRFD, and streaming online at WRFD.com.
With us on the phone is Bill Fetter from the American Minute. You're listening to Bob Burney Live. I'm your guest host this afternoon, Chris Long, president of the Ohio Christian Alliance. You can check out our website at ohioca.org and keep up to date on legislative issues in Columbus and Washington as we enter into the new year 2009. Bill, just before the break, we were talking about America's financial crisis, the seizure of private entities by government authority. We're seeing it in the waning days of the Bush administration with these bailouts, the $700 million banking bailout. And now the president did not get the green light from Congress for the automakers, but yet he appropriated money out of the $700 billion to give them, I forget what it was, $24 billion to help them get along, but it's just staving off the inevitable. If these industries aren't Chapter 11 with reorganization and recontracting with the unions, I don't see how they could stay competitive. I think we're just kicking the ball down the field for a later date.
Well, we really are, and it's interesting. I should have mentioned it earlier. I just finished a new book, and it's entitled Endangered Speeches, How the ACLU, IRS, and LBJ Threatened Extinction of Free Speech. But in there, I talk about how, there used to not be an IRS, and so churches spoke about every issue. Prior to 1913, they endorsed candidates and women's suffrage and prohibition and all that. And then once they created the IRS is when they began to limit the freedoms of the churches. One of the people that concentrated power a lot in the hands of the federal government was Franklin Roosevelt. It's an interesting quote. In 1934, Franklin Roosevelt said this: "A few timid people who fear progress will try to give you new and strange names for what we are doing. Sometimes they call it fascism, sometimes communism, sometimes socialism. They are trying to make very complex and theoretical something that is very practical. The real truth of the matter is that for a number of years in our country, the machinery of democracy had failed to function." Here's FDR saying, democracy just doesn't function anymore, so we're going to do something new. It's practical. Some people call it fascism or, socialism, or some call it communism. It doesn't really matter. I mean, it's like, whoa. So in the time of a crisis, people are like, okay, whatever you got to do to put food back on the table. Ronald Reagan said this in 1984, and this is a quote in my book. He said, "One commonly held view during the Roosevelt era was that all societies were moving towards some modified form of communism." And then, of course, one of the new dealers of FDR was LBJ. FDR was elected in 1932 as president. LBJ was elected to Congress in 1937, and so he basically was a strong supporter of Franklin Roosevelt. And then when LBJ became president, he had his Great Society, which was basically the New Deal. And so this is what LBJ said in 1966. He said, "My administration will not be deterred by those who say to risk change is to risk communism." Boy, that word change comes up again. And so if you're against change, that means that you're afraid of communism? So you got to embrace it. And so this is the situation is if you let the government be the one to give you all the answers, they'll also have all the power and all the control.
Well, Bill, and this is what I want to talk about. Obviously, we're at a breaking point with this country. If there are a number of legislatures across the country that are considering a constitutional convention, to address a balanced budget amendment, because on the federal level, there is the inability to rein in spending, as we talked about. Now, that very well might be the way things go with the Obama administration, because they're faced with realities. We no longer can print meaningless money. We have the communist Chinese that have many bonds and treasury notes against you know, obviously our in you know our value here in this country, and so we're facing a financial crisis that we've never seen. You know, there's been a Russian professor recently who wrote an article about the breakup of the United States, and so secession is not out of the question when you consider that the full faith and credit of the United States is in question in the next few years. So what's your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, we can balance the budget now. You just vote in the people that will do it and vote out the ones that
won't.
But
that's not going to happen in any time soon. I mean, the recent elections have gone to the Democrats. And again, the Republicans have been no help here. But no one campaigning talking about reining in spending. I don't see it on either side of the aisle.
And the next thing is we could pass an amendment. You don't have to have a constitutional convention. You could just pass an amendment and say, okay, this is part of our Constitution. We're amending the Constitution. But you don't have to open it up and have a constitutional convention where you actually, again, once you throw the door open, it's open. And I guarantee by the time that convention's over, we won't be America anymore.
Well, why, if that's the case, we could pass an amendment without a constitutional Congress. Why are even some conservatives calling for one?
Evidently, they're not. They're duped. I mean, I hate to put it that way. I mean, they haven't studied the history of it all. We have again the longest lasting. You know, France has gone through over a dozen different forms of government in the same period of time that America has had only one. Italy has gone through over 30 different forms of government in the same period of time that America has had only one. We have the longest-lasting free government in world history. It's up to us to maintain this. And, of course, that's the oath of the president and the Congress to uphold the Constitution. But
what must conservatives do that have taken losses in the last number of elections? But you could argue it's not really conservatives. It's more the moderate Republicans that have been control and spending Republicans. And President Bush has been a spender, and he's increased spending, and he's put us more in deficit, and he's expanded the role of government. And conservatives aren't for that. So what can conservatives do to gain back and get to center stage again and having the American people hear what they're actually articulating?
Well, I've tried to explain, if you take a pad of paper, you draw a line down the middle, and you put Democrat agenda on one side, Republican agenda on the other side. The Democrat agenda has been social liberals plus government bureaucracy, which makes it more difficult to do business. I hate to say it, but a lot of union wages. That's one of the reasons that businesses move into other countries is to avoid that. And then you have the environmental movement, and that's another cost to do business here that they don't have in other countries. And then you have all the lawsuits that they have here that they don't have in other countries. And so as this Democrat agenda has been in power for such a long time, guess what? Businesses want to avoid it, so they move their businesses overseas. And so let's look at the Republican side of the page. It has been a coalition of social conservatives plus pro-business people. But now that pro-business is split because you have pro-American business and pro-globalist business. So now if you're going to run for office as a Republican, you want business people to support you. Guess what? Most of these business guys have moved their factories overseas. Otherwise, they'd be out of business. And now they're in favor of open borders and, you know, a more globalist type of thing. And so we're fighting ourselves. During the revolution, we had this unique moment in history where the social conservatives and the financial interests of the country were lined up together. And so you had all these rich Virginians and these rich Americans that were willing to put their money on the line and pledge their lives and fortunes and sacred honor for our independence. But after a lot of the Council on Foreign Relations and these different, you know, global business entities, you know, it all started with the income tax. And again, I wrote an entire book. It's called The Interesting History of Income Tax. Prior to the Civil War, we had no income tax. And then Lincoln had a temporary one to raise money to pay for the Civil War. It was repealed in 1873. So again, no income tax. They tried having a peacetime income tax in 1894, but the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional. Boy, those were the days. And so then Woodrow Wilson pushed through the income tax in 1913. 2015, 16th Amendment, which originally it was a 1% tax on the top 1% richest people. Well, the rich didn't want to pay taxes, so what did they do? They took the category that belonged to churches, the 501c3 category, and they expanded it to include charities and educational foundations. So this way the Carnegies and the Rockefellers moved all their money and started the Rockefeller Foundation and Carnegie Foundation. This way they could still control their money, they just weren't taxed on it. You see, you can't tax the rich because they're not rich because they're stupid. They're rich because they make good financial decisions. And they'll either take their money out of factories and put it into foundations, or what happened under FDR, FDR raised the taxes so much that business people began to outsource. And we had the Marshall Plan where we rebuilt Germany and Japan with brand new factories. And so the American business says, well, gee, we can build factories in other countries, and we can have an ownership, and we can import it back into America. And so they began to lobby to reduce the tariffs so they could bring their goods back into America cheaper. Well, if you had an American factory, now you got more competition from your former American business, and so what do? Well, if it's getting real tight, you decide to close up shop over here, build your factory overseas, then you join the team to lobby to reduce the tariffs to bring the goods into America cheaper. And it's sort of like that game we used to play as kids, Red Rover, send Johnny over.
Yes.
And the kids, you know, would run back and forth across the field, and if you got caught, you had to join the other team. And if you could break through, well, you got to run across another time or two. And so you try to make your business work as a pro-American business, but now it's harder and harder because the other countries have cheap labor, they don't have to worry about lawsuits, they don't worry about environmental stuff, they don't have to worry about, you know, all these government restrictions. So finally, the business throws up its hand and says, I either go out of business or I become an importer. And so they move overseas, join the other team, then they lobby to reduce the tariffs so they can bring their goods back in cheaper. So we've basically dangled the financial carrot in the direction of us dismantling our entire industrial base. And now we're seeing it with the auto industry, that all the autos can be made cheaper overseas, and now we're not we can't compete. And
well, there's obviously even a difference between the northern Great Lakes states that manufacture the cars to the southern states, which have foreign companies, and they're paying much less in labor and can be more competitive.
And again, I do want to make a plug for my book, Endangered Speeches, because I have a couple chapters about what I'm talking about. You know, there, the IRS in there. But I ran for Congress, as you know, Chris. And good example, there was a guy in St. Genevieve that had a leather factory where he made these wallets and binders that got sold to Walmart. And he took me through his factory. This is back in 1998, 2000. And he had like 200 ladies sewing these beautiful zipper binders and all the leathers and different colors. And he was so good, he would pay for college education for any of his employees if they wanted to go on to college. I mean, he was just great. Well, a couple years later, I ran for Congress, and he only had a couple ladies in there shuffling papers. And I said, what happened? He said, well, Walmart was his main client, and they came in, and they were going to lower the price that they were paying for his wallets and binders. And he said, I could not buy the raw material for what China could produce the finished product. He said, I either had to lose the contract and go out of business, or I had to become an importer. And he became an importer. He went over to China, subcontracted out some guys to make his binders and wallets and things the way that, according to the specs that Walmart wanted. And so now he joined the other team. And now
wow.
He's wanting the tariffs to be lower so that he can bring his stuff back into America. And so, but what was the choice? He's either out of business or he became that. And so this is the dilemma that the Republican Party's been in. It used to be pro-social conservatives, pro-business, but now it's split and it's pro-American business and pro-globalist business, and that's why everybody's scratching their heads. You know, why is the president dragging his feet trying to, you know, secure the borders? It's because he's got enough, GATT and NAFTA. The business has gotten to the place where we have to have cheaper labor for, you know, some of the businesses that can't move overseas, you know, like farming and so forth. Otherwise, they go out of business. So we're between a rock and a hard place. And can it turn around? Yeah. There's some steps that are really quite simple, but we have to make it cheaper for businesses to be located here than being located in another country.
Do you see manufacturing having a resurgence in the coming years?
If there were a political will, but I don't sense that right now. again, you go to the Council on Foreign Relations websites and you look at these different people, and they are in favor of a global economy where you can make stuff cheaper in one country, and so, you know, let's close down all the factories that make the same thing in another country because it's more expensive. And yeah, and you will have cheaper stuff at Walmart, but we will be they used a term in the 1950s and 60s called interdependence. Rather than independence, they said, well, you know, if every country was dependent on another country for its supplier or its market, we wouldn't have any wars because nobody wants to attack its supplier or its market. So they were pushing this interdependence thing, and it sounds really good on paper until you realize that it leaves out one important ingredient, human greed and ambition, and that's the cause of war since the beginning of time. And so here we've made ourselves interdependent, and, if one of these countries decides to pull the strings, we could be brought to our knees fairly quickly. And, you know, it's very similar to the fall of the Roman Empire. And I wrote another book called St. Patrick, the story of his real life and so forth, and AmericanMinute.com is my website. But in the first chapter of my book on St. Patrick, I give the setting of the world, and Patrick lived right at the end of the Roman Empire. Here was a 1,000-year empire, but the Romans had outsourced all their grain production to North Africa. That was the grain basket. And when they began to be overrun with illegal immigrants, who were the Ostrogoths and Visigoths and the Franks and the Anglos and the Saxons and the Jutes, and as they overran the Roman Empire, they first came slow and learned the Latin language, but then they came over so fast, they just kept their own communities and their own language, and they began to first work as servants, and then they began to overrun the different areas. And finally, one of the tribes, called the Vandals, went through Rome, went through Spain, went into North Africa, and they captured the grain fields. Sort of funny, you can imagine what this tribe called Vandals did when they went through town. They vandalized. they really messed things up. That's where the word vandalized comes from. But anyway, so once the Vandals captured the grain fields of North Africa, then Rome didn't have the resources to mount a counterattack. And then they began to have terrorist attacks with Attila the Hun, wiping out whole cities of 75,000 people. And then they had their military stretched around the world, putting out global fires. But they had a fast and high-tech military. Their road system was so high-tech they could move anywhere in just a couple weeks. But they couldn't sustain long and drawn-out battles, and so they ended up having to raise taxes, which put another strain. And the 5th-century historian Salvian said the tax collector was worse than the barbarians. And and then they had the welfare program. The whole entire city of Rome was on welfare. They'd give out free bread and what they call bread in the circuses. The people wanted violent entertainment, and so they would have the fighting and the killing and the coliseums and so forth. Of course, they had their version of abortion, which was the exposure of unwanted infants, and they were more... you know, the wealthier, classier Romans waited longer to have children because they wanted to enjoy life more, whereas the immigrants coming over had more children and had them quicker, and so they outnumbered the Romans. And so a lot of trends.
A lot of similarities.
And, you know, we can learn from history, but it's sort of like, you know, you take any, classroom, and you're always going to have your jocks, and you're going to have your bullies, and you're going to have your really smart kids, and you're going to have the different... And so it's like, you know, you take any group of humans and put them together, and they'll basically repeat this historically. Now, you know, from a Christian point of view, I always point out that two things happen in times of crises. It's in times of crises that power gets concentrated, but it's also in times of crises that people turn to Christ. So... you know, we're praying that a lot of people come to know the Lord. Well, they may when there's a crisis. But, and you know, then, of course, the third thing is it's in times of crisis that leaders are raised up. And whether that leader is a Moses or a David or a George Washington or an Abraham Lincoln or a Chris Long or somebody in the listening audience. But, you know, in times of crisis is when... I believe that the Lord taps somebody on the shoulder and says, okay, I want you to stand up and be a help in this time. And you know, a lot of people do turn to the Lord. But I'm getting sort of preachy here. But, again, that this book I did on St. Patrick, and then I talked about my book Endangered Speeches, and then my American Minute book is on my AmericanMinute.com website.
Well, Bill, and we want to have you here in Ohio, and I'm going to be contacting your office and making arrangements. We'd like to put you on a speaking tour here. Folks that would like more information about your ministry, give those contact numbers again in the website.
Oh, thanks, Chris. My website is AmericanMinute.com. That's AmericanMinute.com. And then a toll-free telephone number is 888-USA-WORD, 888-USA-WORD. Another book I did is on What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, A History of Islam in the United States. And it's a real eye-opener. You know, we just finished the Christian season, Christmas season, but we wouldn't have even had a Santa Claus if it wasn't for Islamic Jihad. And that's sort of a little tease question. But St. Nicholas was the most popular Byzantine saint over in what is today Turkey. And when the Muslims invaded in the year 1087, they moved the bones of St. Nicholas to Western Europe because Muhammad said to leave no high grave standing. And so they would take the bones of the Christian saints and give them to the dogs. And so they moved the bones of St. Nicholas to Italy in 1087 A.D., and that introduced St. Nicholas to Western Europe. And then, of course, the Dutch immigrants brought him to New Amsterdam, which became New York, and the Dutch pronounced St. Nicholas Sant Niklaus. And that's where we get the Santa Claus. But anyway, he was a real person, lived in the 4th century over there in Asia Minor, again, which is today Turkey. But all this stuff is in the book I did on What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran. So, you know, Western civilization has been threatened by the Islamic expansion for, 1,400 years. And so we can learn from history, and that's sort of my little niche in speaking, is to try to give us a perspective on what's going on today because of what learning from what happened in the past.
Well, absolutely. And, of course, your book, Backfired, and some of your other works as well that you've completed, all are available, and the information at your website at theamericanminute.com or .org.
AmericanMinute.com. And Amazon.com has them, too, if they just look up, Federer.
Well, Bill, thanks for being my guest today. And we're going to have those of you that couldn't hear the entire segment will be posted on our website, also at WRFD.com, and at our website at OhioCA.org. Bill, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you, Chris, and appreciate the great work you're doing.
Happy New Year, and God bless, my friend.
Thanks. Well,
that was Bill Fetter from the American Minute, and again, we'll have that posted on our website at ohioca.org. It will also be up on WRFD.com if you want to hear the entire segment with Bill Fetter, with Dr. David Prentice, and of course with Ken Blackwell, who was on with us earlier today. And I just want to close out with some thoughts as we look into 2009, and obviously there's a lot of anxiety and some apprehension of the new year. A lot of people facing unemployment. They're facing questions whether they'll have a job in the new year. And, of course, the mortgage crisis. And we wanted to get more into that today. But, again, I think it's a time for good Christian people to seek the Lord while he may be found, as the scriptures say, and to have some personal devotion. I want to challenge you to do that. As Bob is always encouraging us to get into our Bibles and to make it your personal habit to hear from the Lord as you read the Scriptures, and that to allow the Lord to guide you and lead you in this new year, that you and your family would be blessed, and that is indeed what we'd like to see happen, and to make a matter and a pattern of prayer in your life. And commit to these things. Commit to these things in reading God's Word, to pray, to have fellowship. If you're not in a good church, if been a while since you've been attending a fellowship, or you've never attended a Christian fellowship, you know, seek out a good church that preaches the Bible, that's uncompromised in believing that the Word of God is the inerrant Word of God, and where they uphold Christ and His teachings, and embrace the Apostles' Creed of the foundation of the orthodoxy of the Bible, and find that in fellowship with good Christian people, and it will be a great strength and a blessing in your life. This is Chris Long with the Ohio Christian Alliance. It's been my pleasure to fill in for Bob this afternoon. God bless you all, and Happy New Year, and we'll see you in 2009. God bless.
Listen, think, discern.